Hello, everyone. Welcome to this session of Sunstone, Finding Faith and Virtue in Resistance. I'm Joanna Smith, and I'm lucky enough to be able to moderate this panel. We want to start on time because we know these women can talk, and we want you guys to have time to ask questions back. So we're going to start on time. Before we begin, I'm going to ask that everyone turn your cell phones off after lunch. They probably got turned back on. So turn them off or put them on silent. Deborah.
My phone literally just went off.
We're going to have a few minutes for questions, so we ask that you hold them to the end. This session is being recorded, and you can purchase at that desk, actually, right out there next to Jack. You can purchase this session if you'd like it for future reference, and if you'd like to share about it. This is 90 minutes long. During the question and answer, please make sure that I'll come up and we'll pass around the microphone. Everything just needs to be in the mic for recording purposes. So this presentation is near and dear to my heart, obviously. Members of Ordained Women have engaged in faithful agitation for gender equality since its beginning. In response, some LDS church leaders have characterized them as neither faithful nor virtuous. That feels warm and cozy. A few church leaders have even imposed ecclesiastical discipline on Ordained Women supporters and board members. Despite this, Ordained Women believes that truth, faithfulness, and virtue can be found in the questioning of, and even in the resistance to church policies, practices, and procedures that result in inequality, marginalization, and exclusion. So this panel is comprised of four board members of Ordained Women: Lori Winder Stromberg, who is amazing, has been in the feminist community for decades and knows all the things.
all the things.
Deborah Jensen, who's a professor of communications and has been on the board as well, actually since its inception as well, right?
Close.
Yeah.
Sorry, someone waved at me.
Brenda Roberts is a lawyer from Atlanta who is the current director, right?
Chair
of Ordained Women. And then Danielle, and you've been on the board for, 4 years now? 3 years? Long time.
I've been on the board since November of 2015, but
she's been with Ordained Women since day one. She's organized a lot of Mormon feminist activism as well. So look forward to hearing from you ladies, and we will give you time, and then I'll come back up for question and answers.
So we get to sit then, right?
Yep.
Okay.
Do you want another mic, though?
I don't know.
We're good for right now.
We'll get it to you just in case.
Okay. So I'm going to use this one.
There you go.
Okay.
Yeah, use that.
Hi. A year or so ago, we had to put down our cat of nearly 19 years, the aptly named Isis. I say aptly named because Isis was a bit of a terrorist, particularly around house guests who would inevitably ignore our warnings to keep their distance. Can everyone hear? A little louder?
Get closer, okay. Girl.
Okay. Should I start again then? Okay. A year or so ago, we had to put down our cat of nearly 19 years, the aptly named Isis. I say aptly named because Isis was a bit of a terrorist, particularly around house guests who would inevitably ignore our warnings to keep their distance. Still, we got used to having Isis around, loved her for what she was, and even found some of her naughty behavior amusing. When I came home from the veterinarian's office, empty carrier in hand, I began to decat the house. I immediately got rid of Isis's litter boxes, of course, washed and put away her water and food dishes, and parceled out her toys to more deserving pets. What surprised me, however, was that I'd become so accustomed to living with cat paraphernalia that throughout the week I kept stumbling across things that escaped my notice. Isis's carpeted kitty cubby, for example, remained in the hallway near our bedroom for nearly a week, where I walked past it, almost tripped over it, really, several times a day. It wasn't that I was particularly sentimental. It was just that I failed to notice it was there. Having grown up in the LDS Church, where we learned public speaking by giving 2.5-minute talks in Sunday school, I immediately recognized this experience as the stuff of which such talks and countless object lessons were made. What remnants of needless attitudes, practices, and policies, particularly with regard to gender, do we retain simply because they've grown familiar and as such unquestioned? It usually takes some kind of discomfort or disruption in our routine thoughts and experiences to open us to needed change, a tragedy or an epiphany, or something as mundane as a question. At last year's symposium, I talked about the fact that continuing revelation is fundamental to LDS theology. Mormons believe that the heavens and their canon are yet open. As we obtain more light and knowledge, I asserted, our institutions and policies should reflect that increased wisdom. Organizationally, only the top Mormon leadership, it is believed, has the institutional authority to receive revelation for the church and make significant global changes. Many are content to leave these aspects of the decision-making process solely in the hands of the all-male hierarchy. However, others believe members have played and continue to play an essential role in the revelatory process by asking questions, articulating a need or concern, and suggesting solutions to pressing problems. President Dieter F. Uchtdorf said as much in a 2012, and much repeated, I must say, in the progressive community, 2012 Worldwide Leadership Training. Quote from President Uchtdorf, if we stop asking questions, stop thinking, stop pondering, we can thwart the revelations of the Spirit. How often has the Holy Spirit tried to tell us something we needed to know, but couldn't get past the massive iron gate of what we thought we already knew? Unquote. This year, I would argue that belief in Mormonism carries with it both a moral and theological imperative to be activist, including inviting revelations of the Spirit by actively participating in the revelatory process. Because in Mormonism, God is not the prime mover of traditional Christianity, our essential selves are uncreated, which suggests our choices have real and profound theological consequence. We become, in a sense, co-creators with God, moral agents striving with God for a more just and equitable world, or not. In this sense, we aren't mere instruments in God's hands, but co-actors with God and radically responsible for our choice either to perpetuate injustice by silence and inaction or to embrace a moral activism that requires us to bring forth goodness, justice, mercy, and equality. A number of us over the years have met with our local church leaders to discuss issues of, by the way, back to that paragraph, it's a little bit packed with theological stuff, so if we want to talk about it later in the question-answered period, feel free to ask some questions, and we can unpack it a bit.
I mean, you can.
A number of us over the years have met with our local church leaders to discuss issues of gender, equality, and inclusiveness. However, they have no power to remedy church-wide structural inequality. Stuck in a sort of catch-22, most personal letters sent to the hierarchy are routinely sent back to stake or ward leaders. Compelled by conscience and theological imperative, what's a Mormon feminist to do? Because Mormon women lack institutional authority and access to those leaders who have the organizational power to receive revelation on behalf of the church, public advocacy is one of the few options open to those of us who see greater inclusiveness in the LDS Church, including the ordination of women. You can imagine my delight, therefore, when I read this year's Mormon Newsroom post marking International Women's Day, because it makes a pretty good case for the sort of moral activism I'm asserting our theology demands. Called Women of Conscience. Anyone familiar with that? Did anyone see it? You should take a look at it. called Women of Conscience, the statement reads in part, and I'm quoting, "Voicing your deepest convictions and living your highest truths may challenge the culture around you," unquote. However, quote, "Freedom of conscience is vital to the exercise of moral agency, especially in the face of opposition. We forge our identities by taking a stand on what is right and wrong," unquote. Not surprisingly, the statement punctuates the LDS Church's current emphasis on the importance of religious freedom, which I affirm as long as it's not used to cloak discrimination. It also explains that taking a moral stand not only includes challenging inequity in our secular institutions, but also within our religious communities, and I quote, "Limiting religious expression disempowers women from a broad range of faiths. The best kind of religious freedom," again, this is from the church's Mormon newsroom, "the best kind of religious freedom enables women to speak out when they see shortfalls in the practice of their faith traditions." My ordained women profile ends with the following. My ancestors were Mormon pioneers who gave up everything for faith and conscience. I honor them by following mine. I'm a Mormon, and I believe women should be ordained. Here.
I want to start.
Oh, you got to have a microphone.
Oh, I'm sorry.
They want to make you famous.
I want to start with reading a couple of verses from James. I picked James because, you know, as Mormons, we often turn to James when we're talking about the story of Joseph Smith. So, but this is from James, the second chapter, the 14th through the 17th verse. Now, it's not from the King James Version because I'm not really fond of the King James Version. So when I joined the church in 2008, I put aside that not fondness and started back trying to use the King James Version. But I've recently decided that I don't need to do that. So this is not from the King James Version, but here it goes. What good is it? And I'm editing a little bit for inclusivity. What good is it, my brothers and sisters, if someone says they have faith but does not have works? Can faith save them? If a brother or sister is poorly clothed and lacking in daily food, and one of you says to them, go in peace, be warmed and filled, without giving them the things needed for the body, what good is that? So also, faith by itself, if it does not have works, is dead. Now, one of the big things in the Baptist tradition where I grew up was to read it for the second time to make sure that people got it. So I'm going to read one more time. What good is it, my brothers and sisters, if someone says they have faith but does not have works? Can that faith save them? If a brother or sister is poorly clothed and lacking in daily food, and one of you says to them, go in peace, be warmed and filled, without giving them the things needed for the body, what good is that? So also, faith by itself, if it does not have works, is dead. This scripture informs my activism. It is no good for any of us to sit in the pews every day. It isn't really any good for any of us to pay our tithes or to do all of the other things if we are not willing to get involved and do something to help someone. Whether that something is giving a voice to the voiceless, whether that something is advocating for those who feel that they have no way to advocate or who have been shut out of advocating, whatever that role that you take is, that's what, to me, true faith, being a true follower of Christ, being a true member of the household of faith is about. That is what informs my activism. That is what makes me do the things that I do every day. It does not mean that your path will be easy. It does not mean that you will be popular. It does not mean that church members will look on you as the good Mormon. My path has led me to lose my calling of Relief Society president, for which I told people I was like a pig in slop in. It was just that great a calling for me. My activism has led me to lose my temple recommend, and I am quite sure if I persist in the path that I am following, my activism may one day lead the church to decide to excommunicate me. But you know what? The church may decide to do that, but the church can't take away my voice. I will still have my voice. I will still use my voice. I will still raise my voice. I will still encourage others to raise their voices. If something is wrong, if something is not right, if something is not inclusive, if something brings pain to our fellow brothers and sisters, then I submit to you, my brothers and sisters, that it is a moral imperative that Jesus is calling upon us to stand up and speak out about those things. Jesus did not tell us that it would be easy. Jesus did not tell us that we would always be popular. Jesus did not tell us that things would always go our way. But what Jesus did say to us is to remember the least of these. He said to remember those who do not have voices. Remember those who are hurting. Remember those who are hungry. Remember those who are homeless. One of the things that I find so frustrating about the church's refusal to understand how much better we would be if we allowed all of God's children to participate fully is that so much work is simply not being done. I live in a ward. It's an inner city ward, and we have problems out the wazoo. We have people who are struggling every day to put food on the table. We have people who literally have to decide between whether they're going to pay the gas bill or whether they're going to get the car tuned up so that they can get to work. We are not serving those people in my ward because we do not have enough priesthood leaders. Yet, at the same time, the pews are full of women like me, women who've been through hard times, women who understand the hard times that some of these members are going through, and women who are ready and willing and able to do the work, but we simply cannot, because our church does not feel that we have been equipped with the right set of genitals to do so.
Amen.
I find that inefficient. I find that to be somewhat ridiculous. When you just think about it from the standpoint of the work to be done, would you really set out, if you had a job to do, and automatically start out with disqualifying over 50% of your workforce? It simply does not make sense. So that is what propels me. That is what keeps me going. When my daughters say to me, you know, Mom, why don't you just come back home to the Baptist church? Because although in the Baptist church, we have these rules about what men and women cannot do, the Baptist church also has a big sense of practicality. So in my mom's church, where there are not a lot of people who have a lot of education, she has been the clerk for 40 years. And I say that's because she's one of the few people who can count past 10. But, you know, it's not really that. But they recognize that she had skills and she had abilities. And although she was a woman, she was the best person in that church to get the job done. So my daughters ask me constantly, why do you keep going back? And my answer to them, and my answer to all of you, if you're wondering, is because I believe that God led me to the Mormon Church. I believe God led me to the Mormon Church with a purpose, with a mission, with something that God wanted me to help get done. And I will stay in the Mormon Church, even if church leaders decide to excommunicate me, until God tells me to stay. So for those of you who are wondering whether it's worth it, I can't answer that question for you. Each of us is on an individual spiritual journey. Each of us has to get up every morning and has to say, am I in the right place? Am I doing the right thing? Is this where God wants me to be? Is this what God wants me to do? And for those of you, when you ask the question and God tells you that the Mormon Church is where God still wants you to be, I invite you to stand up and step out and speak out. You know, I'm not saying that it is going to be easy if you do that, but I am saying that that is what God would have you to do. And I am saying that when we reach the end of this journey, we will be able to say, I did my part. I did all that I could do. I stood all that I could stand. I lifted all that I could lift to make this place more inclusive, to make it more open, to make it more welcoming. I did all I could to show that my faith was not dead, that I was willing to work for the things in which I believed, that I was willing, even when the times get hard, to continue on the path of doing the things that I needed to do. I recently walked the Camino Anglais in Spain. It is a 78-mile journey. It is up and down hills that I, well, mountains, they're not hills, they're mountains. It is up and down heights that I never thought I would be able to ascend. It takes you into valleys out of which I never thought I would be able to climb. While I was on that trek, that pilgrimage, I had several questions and several things that I wanted to commune with God about. And one of the things about which I wanted to commune with God was my continued involvement in the Mormon Church, because I needed to know that I was not wrapped up in anything that I had created myself, but that I was still hearing the voice of God, that I was still being led by God, and that I was still doing what God would have me to do. Well, one of the days when we had to walk 17 miles before we would make it to the hotel that we were going to stay, it was rainy, it was wet, we were walking through a eucalyptus forest. I didn't even know they had a eucalyptus forest in Spain, but we were walking through a eucalyptus forest, and we were walking through a path that was so trodden down that it was almost like walking in a big rut. But the sides of the rut were as tall as I was. I was walking. I was using my hiking sticks that I had bought, but it was rough going. It was slippery. It was cold. I was tired. Every part of my body hurt. I was asking myself, what am I doing here? As I was making that journey and as I was getting ready to walk up another one of those extremely high ascents, I looked down and there was a stick. And I know this may sound a little bit hokey to some of you, but I fully believe that God had heard my prayer, He had heard my cry, and that that stick was provided for me to help me get through that journey. It was a wooden stick, it was as tall as I was, it was tall enough that I could lean on it with my chin and rest a little bit as I was walking. It was, for me, a tender mercy, an answer. I grabbed that stick, I gave my walking companions the poles that I had, and I continued my trek. And I continued to ask God to let me know whether what I was doing was what God wanted me to do. And as I got to the top of the mountain, the rain stopped, the sun came through, you could see birds flying, you could see the rain glistening on the trees, and I received, at least for me, what was the clearest confirmation that the things that I am doing are from God, they are of God. It was as clear as when God told me to join the LDS church, and when God told me when I joined the LDS church that neither polygamy nor the priesthood temple ban had been from God. It was just that clear of a message that, yes, you are doing what I led you to this church to do, and I am not ready for you to leave. So I encourage you, when you are getting tired, when you're getting weary, when it seems like you're beating against a wall that is not going to move, when you're knocking on a door that seems like it's not going to open, or that they're putting bars in front of so that you can't get to, I encourage you to lift up those prayers. And again, if your answer is like that I received, I encourage you to continue to join us in this fight. This church does not belong to our leaders. This church belongs to us. And we have a right to fight to make this church be what God would have it to be. Thank you.
Is this one?
No,
it's not. All right, girl. Be loud.
Will it stretch?
Yeah, I can switch.
We can.
Here.
Cool.
Okay. Just once again, I'm Danielle Mooney, and I'm a late-ish addition to this panel. We had a family event that unexpectedly brought us to Utah this week, and so I'm really glad that I was able to be here with these women who I love so much. And I'm particularly excited because I really love the theme that we chose for this panel about finding faith and virtue in resistance, specifically because it brought immediately to mind for me an essay that I read 5 years ago now, I think, by one of the theologians, one of the women theologians in Mormonism, Frances Menlove, who has a collection of essays that I would highly recommend. But one that immediately jumped to mind for me when we chose this as the theme of our panel is an essay she has on faith and the definitions of faith. And it blew my mind a little bit in terms of my understanding of what faith means, specifically because growing up in the church, the primary understanding that I had of faith was of faith as, definitionally in terms of faith as assent, faith as an assent to a set of statements of belief, and that if I was able to say that I assent to a given statement of belief, that was evidence in an act of faith. And I think that's true, but what this essay did for me was drew my attention to more definitions of faith that I had not heard articulated before and that really connected for me. And those other definitions of faith that she lays out are all, the main thing that they have in common is that they are faith as relational. Not faith in terms of assent, but faith as aspects of relationship. And what that means to me in terms of finding faith and virtue in resistance is resistance is a form of relating to something, right? Like you can be in, being in resistance to something is automatically having a relationship with it. And
in this case, you know, being in opposition, in resistance to the church on the issue of gender equality is often characterized as opposition. But there is a difference, and I think it's critical and important. And the difference is in our feeling and in that in the parameters of the relationship. Resistance as opposed to opposition, to me, indicates a desire not to obstruct or oppose, but to change. And wanting something to change, I think, indicates that you value that thing enough, right, to want it to change. What these ideas of faith as a relationship also really brought home to me is that as members of the church, and Brenda's talked about this a little bit, members of the church, we're responsible for the church because we're in relationship with it. And because it's in relationship to us, we can't have that, it can't be one-way street. That simply doesn't work. On either end, the church needs us, we need the church, or it doesn't exist, right? I mean, that's the only way in which the church even exists. So, in thinking about myself as responsible for the church, that was a major motivation for me in the early movements that in Mormon feminism that I participated in, as well as my participation in Ordained Women, because the feeling of responsibility really weighed heavily on me, and I truly felt and continue to feel that obligation due to the relationship. And something else that, you know, really has stuck with me is a quote from Daniel Callahan, who said, to lean upon the authority of the church by way of defaulting our own responsibility to think and choose is to run from our human dignity, to let others, whatever their statue or office, form our inner life is to abdicate our human freedom. And I don't think it does the church a service to allow to succumb to this abdication. I don't think it's healthy for the church or its members to abdicate their personal authority. And it's certainly not healthy as an individual for me in my life, at the very least. I've can speak to that. And so in that relationship, drawing that boundary and setting a boundary of saying, this is the value that I see and this is the value that I interpret, and in this case specifically with Ordained Women, this value of equality leads me to draw this boundary and to set up this relationship of resistance. And that is where my faith, my loyalty, and my trust in God is going to express itself. I have a couple other quotations, but I think I'm just going to leave it at that because I think this I'm really want Deborah to talk about our action because it like just fits in exactly with what I hope I've communicated a little shakily here today, but just that I really that when we find ourselves in resistance to the church, that the interpretation of what that resistance means is one that other people will try to define for you or will try to apply or make for you, but that interpretation and that understanding of the relationship is only individual. And if resistance is where faith exists for you as well, I would just like to validate that as an act of faith and as an act of loyalty. And I hope that you, like Brenda said, find that perhaps you would also like to combine your acts of faithful resistance with ours, because we really value all of our supporters and all of you who participate in the actions with us and submit your profiles and even just communicate among your friends and family. So thanks.
The computer went to sleep. Hold, please, podcast listeners. Okay, I'm going to just start.
Me to push a button.
I don't want you to push a button. If you touch it, it will explode. She's very bad with technology, you guys. She admits it. Yeah. It's how she gets out of a lot of work, too. Okay, so my job today is to introduce the action that Ordained Women will be planning in... for the fall conference. This is confusing because conference this year is in October, early October. So our action will be the last Saturday in September, Saturday in September, because we'll be planning it around the first session of conference, the women's session. So it's the October conference, but it's in September. Is it not waking up? Oh no, now this isn't awake. Maybe if we unplug it and unplug it in again. That's the only way I know how to fix anything. Sarah. Okay. So I'm going to begin, first of all, by telling you a little bit about... I want to thank everybody for being here because the afternoon sessions are hard. I know you'd rather be taking a nap. Also, there's a session on Mormonism and cannabis that I would rather be at. Not for any silly reasons, but I would definitely rather be there. But I want to say that I believe that this is a very important topic. When Danielle and Brindis and Lori talk about the strength of a church or any organization revolving around the participation of its members, when we talk about the idea that resistance does not necessarily mean opposition, I think those are important. And at the risk of sounding like a doomsday prophet, I think that one of the reasons we haven't seen a lot of major revelation from the church is because members have grown accustomed to allowing that, like we allow it to happen to us instead of participating in it. So the fall action, you can go ahead and, this is, our fall action will be a trek for equality, and we are kind of building it around the idea of reclaiming power. One of the things we wanted to make sure to do was to leave the word women out of it, out of the title, because we very much want anyone who feels like equality is important, who feels like inclusivity is lacking in the church, we want you to join us, to be a part of this. So the first thing we're going to do is, on Saturday, September 23rd, we will do a physical trek, and I'm going to show you the map in a second. We will do a physical trek that will begin at This Is the Place Heritage Park. at the small Eagle Gate there, and then we will walk 6 miles. And I say we, but really I mean Brindis and you guys. We will walk six. It's going to be a 6 mile walk, mostly downhill. Hey, listen, I could do it in high heels if I needed to. But I mean, we will end at the women's session, and we will be submitting a formal request to the church for tickets to the women's session. We're going to request 100 tickets, and we would like to have more than 100 people there with us. The session, we will attend the session as a group. We will sit together, and we will all be wearing purple scarves. And I will explain kind of the reasoning behind a lot of this. The second part of the action will be on Sunday, September 24th, we will be holding a devotional and blessing service presided over by women. Brenda's. She's the chair. She gets to preside over this. And blessings will be given if women feel called to give them and if women feel called to ask for one. Right? I know. This is so exciting. Also, really quickly, speaking of exciting, while Brindis was speaking, I was on my phone, and I want to make it clear that that's because we promised our supporters we would post this information before we gave it to anyone else. So I was putting that up. So I wasn't being, like, on Facebook for fun. Okay. So let's talk about the trek first. Go ahead. So the trek will start. Look, I made a map. Woo! All right. So the trek will start at This Is the Place Heritage Park. We will walk. To Sunnyside Avenue, along Foothill Drive. It's a major road for anyone not familiar. This is a street that people will see us on. We will walk along Foothill Drive to 1300 East, and then we will walk north to South Temple, where we will then proceed. Gosh, I'm such a Utah, and I can do the directions with north, south, east, west. We'll then walk west for a few blocks to P Street, P Avenue, where we will go north. This is the uphill part. We're going to stop at the Salt Lake City Cemetery. Click. And we are going to visit the grave of Jane Manning James. We want to honor anyone who has been a pioneer in our church in any way. We want to honor the different journeys that people take and the different goals that they are working toward, and we believe that Sister James is an excellent representative. She's an excellent story of seeing a vision for herself, petitioning her leaders, and never stopping. And there are other graves too that we can walk past. This is a historic spot in the cemetery filled to the brim with famous Mormons, dead ones. Okay, we will then leave the cemetery and walk down, I can't remember what street this is, and we will walk along South Temple through Temple Square and to the conference center, where we will hopefully have tickets to the women's session. This is a long walk. This is a risk for us. We are asking for bodies. It's probably one of the biggest things that we need is we would really like to have this be a powerful visual image for people to see. And we are welcoming anyone, people like me who I can't make the full walk. I can't physically make the full trek. I'm going to be meeting you guys close to the end. We want this to be accessible. Anyone who can't make the trek physically because they can't get here due to geography, we will be holding proxy cards again. This will be an important symbolic moment, which will then prepare us for the important literal use of our power, which is the next day. And the devotional service is a moment where we believe firmly that women in the church have previously been allowed to give blessings. They have laid their hands on people's heads when they have felt called. They have called on the power of God, and we believe it's time for women to be able to do that again. We also feel like ordained women has a responsibility to provide a space and a moment to do that. So we will be doing that. This will not be a media event. We will be inviting specific members of the press. There will not be cameras because this will be a sacred moment. We also want to highlight again that it will be presided over by a woman in recognition of the fact and in contrast to the reality that women are not allowed to preside over their own meetings. Specifically, the one we'll be attending the night before on Saturday. But this is this will be a moment. It's going to be sacred. That's the plan. This is not a stunt. This is, I don't want to say a gift because that implies we're giving it to other people. It's a gift to us as well, everyone who's going to organize it. It matters. Okay, so what? Let's see, why? I think is the next one. Go ahead. So first of all, we asked our supporters what they wanted, and we've asked them a lot of times, and we asked ourselves, what exactly is it that we want? What drew us to ordain women? What made the first few actions so powerful? What made the actions after that that weren't big media splashes but were powerful to individuals? What is it that we want out of ordained women? And the top three responses were, in basically a tie, was that one, they wanted something that drew the attention of people outside the progressive Mormon community. So they wanted media attention, not because we want to be famous, but because we want people to know that they're not alone if they believe in this. We want them to start asking these questions also. The other two most common answers were, we want something where we get to engage with a representative of the church. It was, for anyone who participated, incredibly meaningful to be able to speak to someone who was wearing an official tag from the church, and they had to talk to each of us one by one. We want to give our supporters that opportunity. And then the third one was they wanted, a lot of our supporters are not in Utah. It's hard for them to get here. So we want to give them a way to participate by proxy. Okay, is Thea going to pick? Push that button, girl. Oh, that was way too many buttons. Second, we want to honor the pioneers in our community. Pioneers who've come before us, pioneers who walk among us. We all have different journeys. We all have different visions. We all have something different that we are working toward. And we want to try to make this an event where we can all come together and push that and push for that idea in person. And then the third one is, the power to bless, the power to preside, the power to speak to our leaders is something that has been taken away from us, and we are claiming it again. I've often cracked the incredibly inappropriate joke that when someone has said, well, why do you have to go to the media, or why do you have to have these events in order to make change? You should just, like, go talk to your leaders. As Lori pointed out, like, leaders in the church who can make the changes we need don't live across the street from me anymore, right? If I'm not Emma in the days of the School of the Prophets, and I want to talk, if I want to talk to the prophet, I don't sleep with them. So I've got it. This is the only way to get there, so I'm going to get there. Right? But gone are the days when we can walk across the street to the red brick store. This is the way we can reach our leaders. And so we want to reclaim that power and give any supporters who want to participate in it or who have felt that desire, this is us, we're going to provide that space. All right, do you push another button for me? All right, so what do we need from you? One, we need volunteers. This is going to be a logistical challenge, we'll say. We're going to ask a bunch of people to walk 6 miles, and it doesn't end in a loop. So we're going to need to find a way to get a bunch of people from the conference center back to where they left their cars. We're going to need help with, just basics, like how do we get those people? We need people who can drive vans. We're in Utah. There are vans and Suburbans everywhere. We need you, okay? We're going to need volunteers on the planning committee. The board is not interested in being this, like, insular, we know everything and you know nothing. What we desperately want is volunteers who will help plan this, and we will give you whatever, like, resources we have, but you are our greatest resource. The next thing, super crass, we're going to need money, right? This is going to cost some money. We may have to rent a couple of vans. We may have to pay for a police escort along the way, because we're going to have to cross a few streets. We're going to have to purchase material to make purple scarves, because the chance to be a group in the conference center in front of the women officers and some of the general authorities, that's a once-in-a-lifetime. That's a huge opportunity, and we want to be able to be visible to them. And then the last thing we need that I already kind of alluded to is we need bodies. The past few actions have been actions you could participate in at home. In April, it was a social media action, and we specifically planned that so that people could save up resources and we could save up resources in order to do this. They have been moments where we've asked people to just, if you can, come stand with us outside the church administration building. The goal wasn't necessarily to be a massive group. This one is. Wouldn't it be great if 250 people, like we had at the first priesthood action, walked along major streets in Salt Lake City in support of equality in whatever form in the LDS church? So we are putting out the call. We're asking you to make plans to be here on September 23rd, and then come with us on the 24th and share your spirit and your testimony. I think that's the last one. Look at that. I totally knew where I was supposed to end. Okay, so now we have, I think, 30... You're the moderator. She's the boss. We have 30 minutes, and this microphone is for you for questions, for... You know, like, give us your email so you can volunteer. But. All right.
Anyone else tear up when they announce that? Yeah, just me?
I'm very nervous about this action. Mark Thomas. Give us some of the details of this. What time do you meet? What do we need to do? What day of the week is this on the 23rd?
Oh, well, okay. So some of the details depend on permitting, but what we know is we plan to meet at 3 p.m. at This Is the Place Heritage Park under the Small Eagle Bridge. It's just right by the parking lot in the visitor center. And then the walk will begin after a prayer. I'm sure we'll have a small service. Eagle Arch. Think, is that what it's called? You're so smart. Okay, so, and then the walk should take roughly 2 hours, but with some stops, we're planning on that we have plenty of cushion to get us to the conference center for the session that starts at 6. The devotional, we are planning, it's in the morning. That's really all I can give you right now. We don't have a location yet. But it's going to happen.
What age would you recommend participate in this hike? In other words, teenagers could make it, but there's a certain point where it's going to be too much trouble to bring little kids, right?
Oh.
So what are you thinking?
Danielle.
Go ahead. I think part of it depends. I think part of that decision would depend on whether you were planning to attend the women's session, which is meant for girls beginning at age 8 up through adult women of any age. So if you were bringing a child younger than 8, you would obviously either need to end with us at Temple Square or have someone there who is going to take over childcare for you from that point on. But a lot of this walk is, it's along sidewalks. These aren't trails. So children in strollers, for example, would be that would work fantastically. As well as if you have children who are, I know 6-year-olds, Joanna made them, who can walk for 6 miles happily. So if that's the case for your children, we'd love to have this be a family event. I think it'd be a really neat opportunity and a really neat event to bring children to. Unlike standing in line, too, in right. particular, because this is a movement and interesting, we're seeing sites in Salt Lake and historic events. I think it actually particularly lends itself well for to be a family event.
And as Deborah said, we know that people have different health conditions and everything. So we will be making arrangements, and part of the plan will be that people can join us at different points in the walk. And that will be part of the coordination. But I will turn 60 this year, and I was a couch potato, and I went to Spain and walked 78 miles. So I'm saying that, I you know, if it is not... I'm looking forward to this 6-mile walk. And so those of you out here who are in your 60s, come on, we can do this. We can outwalk the young ones.
And pray for no inversion.
And we're giving you like 2 whole months to train.
Several questions, if I may.
Oh, good.
One, for people to brainstorm solutions to logistical problems, is there a blog page or something with a comment section? Something?
There will be.
Okay, good to know. Just one idea came to mind, for example, ferrying people back and forth. If you come in a car not by yourself, or if you come with 2 people, then just bring 2 cars. Mm-hmm. Hopefully that will help. Another question is, I've never been to women's conference because only women go, right? So you need only 100.
Except the presiding male authorities.
Oh, right.
And also, additionally, I attended at the tabernacle, and there was a man sitting behind me with his date. So okay. I don't know that they would kick you out, but they probably... This would be a great place, as Joanna said, for male allies to step up and walk with us.
Right.
And then find a way back. Y'all are smart. You'll get there.
But you need at least 100 females for the tickets.
Yeah.
So everybody else is, you know...
So there will be an event specifically for the conference section that we'll ask people to RSVP to if they're going, so that we can track how many tickets we still have left.
Super. Mm-hmm. And last question. I don't know much about ordained women, which is why I came to this panel to learn more about it. And I'm just curious about its size, its scope, just some basic details like that, if you could help me understand the picture of the organization.
Me? Okay. Well, I mean, our scope is we intend to take over the world.
Nice.
So, I mean, and by that I mean we have members around the globe, and not members, supporters. We have people who've posted profiles. We're up to, can someone help me with a number? Almost 700 profiles. Right, and I mean, that's impressive. I would like to just say, and a profile is on the website, ordainedwomen.org. We invite people to submit their testimonies. They're beautiful. If you haven't read them, you really should go to the website and read some of them. And I will explain why here. When the website launched, I was sent a link with I tell this story all the time. Have you seen this? With 17 exclamation points and question marks. Because people knew that this was my jam, right? Ordaining women was seriously something I believed in. And I read, there were 26 profiles on the website, and I read every one of them. I read every word of the website, of every page. And then I submitted mine, and it was a chance for me to write down things that I had previously only whispered to the people in the church I trusted the most. Things like, I want to hold the priesthood. I want... I wanted to stand in the circle when my baby was blessed. I wanted to help baptize my friend when she joined the church. And I believe that I know women who would be amazing bishops. This was... So the website and the profiles are a chance for women and men and all of our siblings to write those things down, say them out loud. And they end with, I'm a Mormon and I believe women should be ordained.
I,
The question I have is about the devotional, because that's new ground. And so for, I guess, a long time, I've sort of wished that I could have a blessing from a woman. But given this being new ground, is that something, can men request blessings from women at the devotional?
Yes, I don't see why it would be problematic at all. And it's new ground, but it's reclaiming authority that we have had. And particularly for those of us who are converts like me, I came from a tradition where really and truly, when you really needed a prayer, the person that you wanted to find was that old grandmother, that person who had been through something, who had seen God work in her life, and who could lay down one of those heartfelt prayers. So when I got into the Mormon Church and recognized that my ability to put my hands on one of my fellow believers and call down a blessing and call on God's name, that was severely circumscribed, it was as if something had been ripped from me. And as I learned about our Mormon forebears and learned that women had done these things and that had been taken away from them, I mean, it was just like, we've got to get this back. We've got to stand up and say, we are not doing anything that is forbidden. We are doing what we did throughout history, throughout the history of the church.
I'm going to interject there for 2 seconds, then I'll let Danielle talk. But Ordained Women a couple of years ago did a photo series of envisioning our future. I was on the board at the time, and there was just a series of pictures of, you can't be what you can't see, and so there was pictures of women baptizing people, and there were pictures of women giving blessings. One of the photos was, and let me preface this a little bit, I had had a profile up, I was on the Ordained Women board, and I had been punished by the church, surprise, surprise, and so it wasn't really that big of a deal to me that I thought when I was asked to pose for a picture with Brenda's blessing me. Brenda's in Pioneer clothing, me in Pioneer clothing, and her giving me a blessing. I will, without a doubt, say it was one of the most spiritual experiences of my life, and she didn't say anything. It was a picture. But the 45 seconds of that picture shifted, and I mean, it just lifted a veil that I had had over me of allowing women to teach me spiritually. And so when you announced this action, I just started bawling, because I think it's such a gift to be able to lift that veil for everybody. So
I just wanted to also add, because I think that the idea of reclamation is true, but I also think an important aspect of this is to note that women continue to bless one another and their children and their families today. That women in the church
in secret
do this, but the key is that it happens in secret, it happens in private, and one of the important aspects of this is that it is public, in the sense that we are not keeping secret what is happening or what our desire is for people who feel called to bless or give blessings at this devotional. It's particularly important because the drive to privatize women's lives is a critical component of removing or limiting women's power. When women are confined to their homes, when they are not allowed to speak in public spaces, or when they are not allowed to act with power and authority in public spaces, they don't have power. They don't have authority. And when those things are secret, It is a loss to women themselves, and it's a loss to everyone who's losing out on the experience of women's gifts and women's power. And so the public aspect, I think, is really important, as well as acknowledging that this is something that women do, and they just don't talk about it, and we think it's time for women to talk about it.
Hi. First of all, I just wanted to thank you for all of your remarks. That was incredibly inspiring. So I guess for me, the...
Stand up.
Okay, yeah.
We kind of want to make your shirt the theme. So, come walk with us, affirmation.
Yeah, I work with affirmation, LGBT, Mormons, families, and friends. My mom's on the board. Oh, yeah,
get right
sorry.
Up there, kid.
Yeah,
there
so I do a lot of work with affirmation, Mormons, families, and LGBT, Mormons, families, and friends. Right, sorry. mics. Anyway, and so LGBT issues are more my personal experience in fighting for equality within the church, and particularly me as a transgender Mormon, the gendered aspects of... of current church practice has definitely been something that's affected my life personally and the lives of a lot of people that I care about. I do want to say thank you very much for making this event, the march, something that's inclusive in the issues that it covers, that it's fighting for all kinds of equality. I think that that's really important, you know, a focus on intersectionality in within church activism. Sorry, I'm losing my train of thought. I'm just curious, has Ordained Women as an organization established... I don't know if there's been a lot of discussion within Ordained Women of... gender issues in the somewhat broader sense of also including, you know, for trans and non-binary and intersex people, the ways that that has affected people within the church, and what your hopes for in terms of change in church policy would be.
There have been those discussions. Let me start my answer off by saying this. When, just like Deborah did, I went to the profile page and I looked at the profiles. And one of the things that struck me was that I didn't see a lot of people that looked like me. And my concern was, and one of the things that made me get involved, is that I did not want us to reach a point where women were one day ordained, but we looked around and it was all white women. And part of what we were trying to convey in the powerful image that Joanna is talking about is that if we talk about our past, women who looked like me would not have been included in that past, would not have been able to give blessings. And what Ordained Women wanted to go on record as saying is that as we move forward in the future, we want to make sure that we are inclusive. And we are learning, we are growing, our minds are becoming more open. So yes, we are looking head on at the issues of when you define gender in a very binary sense, that you are still excluding too many of our siblings. And what we really are working towards is a church where all of God's children will be able to serve to the best of their skills and abilities. And we won't put any of these artificial barriers in the way of their service.
Could we go back and unpack that paragraph, Lori?
Oh my gosh. Oh. I think she's asking you to do that.
read it.
You want me to read it again?
Possibly a third.
Okay. I have to find it first. Okay. I would argue that belief in Mormonism carries with it both a moral and theological imperative to be activist, including inviting the revelations of the Spirit by actively participating in the revelatory process. I think that's pretty clear given what I said before about the revelatory process. Is it not? Are there questions about that? In other words, I think we think too narrowly about the whole process of revelation. We think of it more in terms of this hierarchical thing of all of a sudden God gives you an epiphany or the prophet an epiphany, and then it flows down. But we see throughout the history of the church and in scriptural texts that often answers to revelation comes in response to questions, comes in response to people expressing concerns. That's pretty clear. And so I think it's really important that we see revelation as a participatory, as a whole, the whole body of the church participating in inviting the revelations of the Spirit. That's clear? Move on? Okay. Anyone want to add to that? Okay. Because in Mormonism, God is not the prime mover of traditional Christianity. We're on that page, right? Everyone on that page? Anyone questions about that? Okay. We don't believe, we use the language of traditional Christianity, but we often mean very radically different things. And we could have a discussion about this because our theology is in some ways wide open on some of these issues. They're much debated, but we sort of believe in we use the omnis. God is omnipresent. Not omnipresent, but in Mormonism that's a problem because we believe in a physical being. But anyway, but omniscient, and yet we don't really believe in them.
Double meaning.
Well, we don't, yeah, because we don't believe God is the prime mover. I don't know, Paul, do you believe God's the prime moving? No, but I know that Paul and I. No. No, but there. I sort of give a nod because because we've talked about this before, and there are some Mormons who actually whose leanings lean a little more toward the prime mover. But anyway, but the implication of our theology, and then I go on with that, is that there is this very strong belief in Mormonism that our essential selves are uncreated and co-eternal with God.
Yeah.
Okay.
And see, I think one of the things that's really struck me about Mormonism is that I think sometimes we think we're more unique than we really are. Because certainly growing up as Baptists, we certainly claimed the ability to talk to God, to hear from God, to listen to God and be directed by God. And we also did not take the position that you were just sort of sitting back and waiting to be acted upon by God, that you were a very active participant in your spiritual journey, a very active participant in the blessings that you received and the blessings that other people may receive because of your actions. So while I may be on the side of Mormonism that I like the omnis better than Lori does. I think we can all agree that when we're talking about the revelatory process, that process cannot happen until we are active participants in that process. If we're not showing God that we are seeking these things, that we are ready to handle these things, that we are open to these things, I don't think these things will happen. So it is very much an active religion, not a sitting back just sort of waiting for things to happen, but we are out there marching and working and doing, and that's why that verse from James is so important to me. It's not a sit on your rusty dusty kind of faith. It's a get up and do things.
And I just want to tie that to the action, because we have a strong history scripturally, but also in Mormon history, right? We're talking from Joseph Smith to now. There is a lot of history of very active members making things happen, approaching their leaders. The fact that we don't do that anymore is a problem. And I think we see that in like 40 years of kind of no major revelation, no major progress happening. And I believe that, I mean, to be completely like sacrilegious, I think Heavenly Father and Heavenly Mother are up there waiting for us to do something. They're waiting for us to declare that we are shockingly ready for the power of God, for their power to be used by anyone who's worthy and feels called, and not to be limited to less than half of the people here, right? I think they're waiting for us, and we have a responsibility. We are those co-creators.
Cool.
Do we want to go more with this, or we are...
There's another question. You got to do this. Like, my head hurts.
No, but it...
That Mormon theology stripped of nonsense.
The authentic Mormon theology is extremely in favor of what you're doing. Both the resistance and the emphasis on women and the emphasis on equality. My question to the panel is this: somebody said that we don't want to wake up and find that, you know, it's all white women, right? But my question is this: what do you think about waking up and finding out that you're all deacons?
Yo. Okay, so first of all, okay, I have so many responses to this. One, his question was, what happens if we wake up and find out that we're all deacons? So I'm assuming you're saying, like, what if we get a, like, yeah, you can be ordained, but you can only be a deacon. Yo, okay, first of all, that question is like for you to minimize being a deacon to a bunch of women who can't even be a deacon. If I woke up tomorrow and my 11-year-old daughter could be ordained when she turns 12 in October, I would do a freaking naked dance out in the street, because that would be incredible progress for my daughters to be able to pass the sacrament in church. That is something I never dreamed of 5 years ago. And the thought of that being something to look down on is, like, actually kind of offensive to me, but not really, because I know who you are. Second, my second answer to that would be, when my son was 12, I bought him a book called Even the Prophet Was a Deacon Once. I'm not saying I want to be ordained to a deacon and stop there, but being ordained to anything, that progression, right? Once I'm a deacon, I can move forward. I'm starting as a deacon, like, I'm sure it's not going to be for me. I guarantee I'll be kicked out before anything like that happens. But for my daughters, right, I'm going to walk so that they can one day be like a deacon. I don't want to be a deacon. I want to be an elder. Eldress.
A bishop.
So I love everything that Deborah said, but also I think that idea of that women would necessarily be incorporated into
an existing system and hierarchy is part of the problem that we were talking about with, in terms of revelation and co-creation. That is too limiting. If our imaginations are not big enough to hold what God can offer, we won't get it. So if our imagination can only extend to slipping women into an existing system, then probably that's what we'll get. But if our imaginations are bigger than that, God can do bigger than that. God doesn't want us to just open the curtains for one another. God told us God wants to build a whole new house. Okay? God has a plan that we can't see, right? And we don't know. And if we, our imaginations aren't willing to be extended and to hear new things, we won't get them.
Okay, I know we're almost up. I'm going to be obnoxious. I'm going to say it. I'm here from Europe. And European women have profiles on ordained women. And we want this just as much as our sisters and brothers who live here in the U.S. Yeah. I've been an expatriate for almost 20 years over there. And I can tell you, it's the sisters that are there that want this are strong. So, my challenge, how do we make it more than proxy for European women?
That is such a good question.
How do we really get involved? I mean, there's a little tiny dinky international page, and we need to take it further than that because we are isolated. We can't get together and give blessings. We are even in further secrecy than you here in the U.S. I didn't tell my European sisters that I was going to do this. But boy, I'm sure going to post it on there now.
And Gail, I don't have good answers to your questions. I think part of it is us recognizing and reminding ourselves every day that our church says it's a global church, and ordained women must be a global organization. I think it's being creative and thinking outside of the box as to how to reach out to our European siblings. I know it must be frustrating when you are one or two or three people in a country who are ready to do this. How do we create those ties? And I think what we're going to have to do is let y'all lead the way. Let y'all tell us what needs to be done and let us help provide the tools and the resources to help do the things that y'all have shown us that need to be done.
Yeah.
Yes.
And we have about 5 minutes left.
Okay.
Hi. I have great concerns about the role of authority and power in oppression in the church. I know that there are the actions that you are taking, but have you considered any ways for us to personally address these things in our own wards, but in a more united way as a group? Are ways of dismantling the chains of abuse that do happen?
Light is the best disinfectant.
You know, there are other groups besides ordained women that are working for equality in the church. One of my dreams is that all of these groups, all of these different groups, that we will join forces and that we will work together so that we can make these changes. The other thing is it is very difficult in our individual wards often to speak up, because many of us do not know whether we are the only person who feels that way. I mean, the church makes it, if you put out an invitation and invite people to come talk to you about these things, the church sees that in and of itself as you doing something that you shouldn't be doing. But we are open to ideas. We recognize that this cannot be a little group of people, whether they're centered in Utah, whether they're centered in the U.S., that this has to truly be a worldwide organization, and it has to start at the grassroots level. In my ward, one of the things that I was the proudest that I was able to do, not under the umbrella of ordained women, but in my role in Relief Society president, was to advocate for a Sunday school class to get started that was called Strengthening Parents. So for all of the single mothers that we had in our ward, it was like we had Strengthening Marriage, but no one seemed to recognize that we had all of these sisters who needed this class. It took me over 2 years to convince the people in my ward and the people in my stake to do it, but they did it. So it's those kinds of grassroots kinds of activities that we have to be involved in to start dismantling it on the grassroots.
And there are groups in various areas getting together, and Karen Rosenbaum is involved in a group in Northern California. And a number of, we would love to see a lot of local actions. We would like to see a lot of grassroots movement. And, I mean, things that you can do is make appointments with your church leaders to talk about how they can create a more inclusive community in your stake. Yeah. I've done that periodically, and of course I've had some pretty extraordinary leaders with a great deal of integrity who have protected me.
So. Oh, Danielle wants to say something.
One last comment from everybody, and then we'll
wrap up. I know this is the very end, so I'm just going to speak quickly. But it is, unfortunately, in some ways, a very, very individual process. I think that's something that I've noticed is, for example, in Ordained Women, we have a private group for our supporters on Facebook, people who have posted profiles. And I think that finding places in which you can get support and ideas and resources on how to communicate with your leaders and to feel like you have someone at your back, even if they can't physically be there, because sometimes, you know, we really are one person to a ward, or sometimes you are blessed to have a number of people in your ward who are willing to get together to address a needed change. I think that something that struck me about your question is that I do think that those of us who can speak up, who don't bear risks of it's hard even to articulate all the possible risks, you know, that can come with speaking, of stepping out of line and of making yourself unusual. But if those risks are either don't exist for you or are tolerable, and this is something that I say as someone who looked around one day and realized, you know, my marriage isn't going anywhere. My mom isn't going anywhere. My job isn't going anywhere, and I'm not physically threatened. So for me, that created an obligation. And for those of us who are in those situations, I think that's important to see where you have an obligation and to try to step up. And if you're not in that situation, to give yourself grace and to seek the support that you need in order to be healthy and to be safe.
So I'm going to close with this. We would like you to be a part of our community. This is an inclusive mission. Our mission and our vision is inclusive. So please, if you feel able to and called to, please submit a profile. Go to ordainwomen.org and submit a profile. And then you'll be part of our supporters group. But if you don't feel called to do that, visit our Facebook page. That's where we'll be giving you information about the upcoming action. Come be part of that community. Like the page and occasionally engage in conversation. It's really fun.
Nope, she said no. You're done.
We're so, done.
No. Real quick.
We do have to say, though, I don't want to minimize the risk that is involved, that a number of people have faced, but by far the majority of our supporters have not faced
any risk.
Mm-hmm. I wouldn't say that, but haven't faced ecclesiastical sanction or any
official discipline.
Yeah. So,
okay. Thank you.
Thought I was.